session number 23205, reel 1.
Tony Leake, reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Bradford, Yorkshire.
Which year was this?
1925.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Bradford?
I did, yes.
Where did you go to school there?
Bradford Grammar School.
So how old were you when you finished there?
Well, I left school when I was 17 and joined the army, underage.
So we're talking about 42?
1942, yes, I enlisted underage with a false date of birth.
What about the early part of the war then? You were at school during the war?
Yes. I wasn't evacuated anywhere.
Can you describe what it was like being at Bradford Grammar in the early part of the war, please?
I don't know quite what to say about that. I mean, things went on pretty much the same. When I was 16, I joined the... I can tell you, when France fell in 1940... I was doing my equivalent of O-levels then, although we didn't, what they call school certificate, and there didn't seem to be much point in doing it. We didn't know what was going to happen. It was a terrible shock in Britain that France had surrendered. And then there were some Frenchmen who were evacuated to Bradford, French troops that is, and we didn't know what was going to happen to them either. And it was very, we expected invasion. My mother's brother was a GP near Scarborough, at a place called Sherburne. And he had three children, they were younger than me, about 8, 9 and 10. And they came to stay with us, with their mother, because we thought that they might be invading East Yorkshire. And they stayed with us all that summer. And then in September it looked as though it wasn't going to happen and people became more relaxed. But it was still a very uncertain time. And we used to get all this bad news and we wondered how we would all end up. I don't think we quite realised how desperate the situation was. I mean, it was obviously bad, but we didn't realise it was really desperate, and I wonder that Britain survived, although it's obvious that if Britain had been occupied like the Channel Islands were, that the fight would have gone on in Canada, Australia and the British Empire, although it didn't in the French Empire.
Did Bradford get much bombing?
Very little, one or two bombs, but very little. We were very surprised at there weren't a lot of bombs in the West Side, that in the sort of textile part of the West Riding, but they certainly got bombed Sheffield. And we used to get air raids, we used to hear the planes going over at night, so sort of German planes, they had a certain noise there, their engines, and I think probably they just sent a few over so that the air raid sounds would sound and people would have to have a bad night. That's what we guessed anyway. They used to light fires on the moors as well, in the hope that the Germans had thought that they'd been bombing there, and they just bombed, and that they would bomb the fires and do no damage, of course. When I was 16, just 16, I joined the Home Guard.
What was that like?
Oh, it wasn't the joke it is in Dad's army. We were well trained, and a lot of the men, it was boys and men who had been soldiers in World War One, and it was done properly, and we were trained on home defence. We used to guard the electricity works and the gas works, and we used to go one or two nights a week, and every Sunday morning we used to go drill and weapon training and even throwing live grenades. And we were quite smart. I mean, that sort of appearance in Dad's army would not have been tolerated for one moment.
For example, what wouldn't have been, what specifically wouldn't have been tolerated?
Well, the way they dressed with scarves on and all sloppily dressed and hats back to front nearly and all that sort of thing. But, they didn't go around like a bag of rags, and you'd think they did, but from the Dad's army thing, no, it was quite... And it was a very useful force to the government, because home defence troops like that knew the area well, and it would have been invaluable in the case of actual invasion or even parachute drops by the Germans, and rounding them up and so on. And of course it did release regular army soldiers for more active duties.
So you had your own rifle, did you?
Yes, but we didn't take them home. They did it in 1940, I think they did. But by the time, when I joined it, what would it be, about April 1941, we used to keep them locked up in an armoury. And we used to draw them out just for training purposes, and then they'd go back in again and be locked securely. Like in Bradford, they were locked, the armoury was in the cells of the old courthouse. So it was pretty secure there.
Was this an army issue type rifle?
They weren't the standard British Army rifle, they were a Canadian one, called a Ross rifle. Now, the problem with that was it took different ammunition, because the standard calibre of the British Army was 0.303 of an inch, and the Canadians were 0.300, which was the same as the Americans. So the ammunition was not interchangeable, although, I mean, it sounds... very close. They wouldn't have fired. So we had these Canadian Ross rifles, and we had the hand grenades, and we had some sort of anti-tank weapon called the Blacker Bombard, which was a bit like a Piat. But mainly. We did drills, and we did these guard duties, and sort of one night a week you'd be on guard all night at the electricity works or the gas works.
Was it called the Bradford Home Guard?
Well, there was a Bradford Battalion. Now, the Home Guard was in a battalion, an ordinary battalion, there's 600 to 700 soldiers, and you had three rifle companies, which would be about 120 each, and a headquarters company. But in the Home Guard, there were these companies. There were four companies in a battalion, and each company was nearly as big as a battalion. There were a lot of men in one company. A lot more than 120. I don't know exactly how many, but maybe double that number at least.
Was this an enjoyable time for you in the Home Guard?
Well, I quite enjoyed it, yeah. But, I mean, I had to fit in my schooling as well, because I took my high school certificate, equivalent to A-levels in chemistry, physics and maths, and I had to do that.
Could you tell me again about joining the army, please?
Well, I got my high school certificate in July 1942, and then I went back to school in the autumn. And what they used to do at Bradford Grammar, because they've got a good academic record, they used to send us to Oxford and Cambridge to try to get open scholarships. And I had to go once, and I didn't get in, so in about October, with some of my pals in the Home Guard, we decided to join the army. So I went to the recruiting office in Bradford, and they said, come back when you're 18. So I changed my date of birth and went to Leeds and got accepted there into the West Yorkshire Regiment. And in those days, infantry training was pretty tough. This, I don't know if you've been watching you want me to say? I don't know if you've been watching this one called Lad's Army at all on the TV.
Is it something to do with the National Service?
Yeah. And that was absolutely ridiculous. Fellas with a kit all neatly laid out, and somebody, sergeant, comes round and finds a minute fault in something and tips the whole lot onto the floor and that sort of thing. That didn't occur. I mean, what they would do is, I mean, they were in the back room and everything was laid out neatly. Not extraordinarily neatly. And there was a fag end or a matchstick on the floor. Now, that would cause tremendous disruption. This place is filthy, you know. Confined to camp for the next week and scrub the floor and that sort of thing. But mainly the training concentrated on field training. You did a certain amount of rifle drill.
Where did you do this basic training?
Berwick-on-Tweed. I joined the West Yorkshire Regiment, and at Berwick-on-Tweed it was called an infantry training centre. And it was there were three different regiments there. There was the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry, the Coilers, the Lancashire Fusiliers, and the West Yorks. And we did a lot of hard training there, and a lot of PT. I mean, sort of thing about, I don't know how many men you'd have with a telephone pole, and doing exercises with that, as you can imagine, pretty hard going and
swinging it about.
Yeah, that's right, and a lot of PT and route marches, 20 miles or more. Really got us fit. And I did all right because, like anything else, I was good at distance running, cross-country running. So I ended up by running for the Infantry Training Centre in some competitive sports with other units in Northumberland. And then, when I finished my training, I was posted not to the West Yorks Regiment, but to the Lancashire Fusiliers. Now, whilst I was at Berwick-on-Tweed, they classified me as a potential officer. In addition to all the outside training, that they did these, what they call personnel selection tests, where they had psychiatrists in charge, and you did all these quiz questions, and you know, you've got which of these pictures is right, and you've got to fit the triangle into the right opening, four different pictures, and that sort of thing. Anyway, they decided I was a potential officer, and I went to Catterick. I was only 17 then. And they said, oh, well, you're all right, they said, or something to this effect, but you're a bit young, so come back again later. And then I sort of realised that the sort of life expectancy of an infantry officer is about 3 weeks on active service, so I didn't apply. Again, I let it drift, sort of thing, and nobody bothered me. I mean, if they'd sent for me, I'd have gone, but perhaps it was with me going to a different regiment. And, you know, I was in the Lancashire Fusiliers, and they were doing coastal defence, 2nd, 5th Battalion Lancashire Fusiliers at Folkestone. And of course, from Folkestone, you can see the French coast on a clear day. Some people said you could even tell the time on the town hall clock at Boulogne. But you'd have to be pretty good with a powerful telescope to do that. We didn't get much activity there. They used to do a bit of shelling, but not much. And we used to have one whole company ready every night, what they called an inline picket, ready to go out to meet any possible invaders. It was at Folkestone initially in that summer, from about June to September, and then we moved to Margate. And
how did you like being in Lancashire Fusiliers?
Oh, I didn't mind. They're all right. I mean, there's not so much difference between Yorkshire and Lancashire. It's just a sort of friendly rivalry, really. and they call you Fusilier instead of private, you see. It's a bit of a distinction. There are not many people I'm a rank of fusilier. And anyway, whilst I was there, I found out that you could apply to join the to be trained as a glider pilot. And so I applied, and right at the beginning of January 45, they sent for me to go for a medical, and this was at the RAF, the Air Ministry, which was in Kingsway in London, and I went and had this medical, and they said, well, you're all right, but your eyesight isn't good enough, you know, it's got to be a bit better than this without glasses for us to accept you. And then they said, well, perhaps you would like to become a parachutist, you see, they said. Well, I thought I might as well have a go. And so I landed up at the parachute at the Airborne Forces depot in February 45, where the training was extremely hard there. It was winter, there was snow on the ground, and we were going out with just thin denim uniforms on, and training, and we'd do 10 miles before breakfast and that sort of thing, and a lot of PT. And then, how long would it be, perhaps a fortnight like that, and then we went to Ringway, where Manchester Airport is now, which was the parachute training school, and there we did all our, what they call synthetic training, inside one of the big hangars there, so learning how to land and going on these things like a trapeze with a pulley attached running down, and the fan where you sat at 30 feet above the ground there, and you pushed yourself off from the seat, and there was a cable attached to a fan, and as you fell, the fan rotated more quickly, and of course that sort of slowed you down. So it was more like a controlled parachute landing and that sort of stuff, what they call this, as I say, synthetic training. And after that, we went on to aircraft. Now, the standard aircraft at that time was the old Whitley bomber. And it had an aperture in the floor, about 4 feet in diameter. A circular in the Whitleys. And you sat on the edge of this aperture and pushed yourself off, and you went down, and as you went down there was a line attached to the top of your parachute webbing line attached to another similar one inside the aircraft, which was fixed, and as you went down this static line pulled the rigging lines and the canopy of the parachute out, and then it got to a certain tension, 100 pounds, they called it 100 pounds tie, and the tiny bit of nylon cord between the strop and the static line broke, and you're free, and the parachute had opened. But I should have said, before we went on the aircraft, we did balloon descents, and this was he went up in a balloon about 4 feet square, this cage, no, a little bit more, about 6 feet square, because the aperture was the same size as the Whitley, about 4 feet in diameter, and it would take four parachutists and an instructor, and you went up to 700 feet in this barrage balloon cage of the barrage balloon, and you jumped from there. And the same idea as the Whitley, you jumped out and the static line pulled the chute out and then it opened. But you fell further when you jumped from a balloon, you fell about 200 feet before your chute developed. But with the Whitley, it was quicker than that because of the slipstream caught you, and you only fell about 130 feet. 1 3/5 seconds or something like that, a very quick it was. And so I did about three balloon jumps, about three Whitley jumps, and I did about two from a, A Dakota, because they've just introduced it, and that's a side door jump, which is a lot easier. It's just like getting off a bus. And then I was posted after that. That I qualified as a parachutist about the end of March. I had a bit of leave, and then in April I was sent to the 8th Parachute Battalion, which was at Tilshead on Salisbury Plain.
Before we take up with 8th Para, why had you applied to be a glider pilot in the first place?
I thought interested in flying. Oh, I could fancy that, I thought. I used to make model aeroplanes. And, mind you, I was lucky I didn't get that, because the glider pilot casualty rate was the highest of any unit in the army, the fatal casualty rate. And I qualified as a parachutist at the end of March, and then I spent a couple of weeks near Chesterfield at one of the depot places, and I was posted then to the 8th Parachute Battalion at Tilshead on Salisbury Plain, which was part of the 6th Airborne Division. And there again we used to train hard. I mean, you could do up to 50 miles with your kit in 24 hours. How grand was that? And we did what you call field training out in the woods, and went in the woods, and then we went to Southampton on some bomb sites, house clearing and all that sort of thing. But the CO of the 8th Para Battalion was a legendary airborne man called Alistair Pearson. And he was an incredible man. He'd been in the 1st Battalion of the parachute from the early days of parachuting, when they started, so about 1940. He'd been in Tunisia with the first parachute battalion. He got the MC, and how many did he got? Two bars. He got the MC and the DSO and bar in Tunisia for leadership, because he always led from the front. And then they went to Sicily, and then they had another desperate situation in Sicily, and he got a further bar to his DSO, and then he came back to England. And as our battalion commander. And he was one of these incredible people who have a sort of, they're born leaders. And he was a Scotsman. He lisped. He talked with quite a strong Glasgow accent. And he wasn't a very even-tempered man, but the lads would have followed him anywhere. They loved him, you know, he was a great fella. And he died about 5 years ago, survived the war. Anyway, I'm just digressing about him. But anyway, he was the CO. And he used to say, well, you work hard for a fortnight, he says, and then you can have a 48 hours leave and the weekend off. And that's how we did it for about 6 weeks up till D-Day. And about 2 weeks before D-Day, it'd be about the 20th of May, thereabouts, we had the royal inspection. King and Queen and Princess Margaret and Princess Elizabeth came in and inspected the whole of the 6th Airborne Division on Salisbury Plain. So all the parachute regiments and the gliders and the artillery and everything else. And we were in full battle kit, and it was hard work standing there with all this stuff on for about 2 hours. But we were luckier than another battalion who had to stand there with all that on, plus a parachute weighing 23 pounds. And what they never mentioned, by the way, about the King used to wear makeup. Did you know that?
I've heard other people
yes,
say that.
Yes, oh, definitely, because he was as close to me as I am to you. And we were amazed about that, really. And then, shortly after that, within a week, We were sent to a transit camp at a place called Blake Hill Farm near Cricklade, which was an RAF station. And the camp, this transit camp, was built alongside the airfield, put barbed wire around, and we were told that we mustn't talk to anybody, and anybody who broke out of the camp would be court-martialed. And we were there about a fortnight before D-Day. We knew it was what it was all about, you know, but we didn't know when we were going. And we went across to the airfield about two or three days before D-Day, and we drew chutes. And we used to, what we did was fitted the chute and then chalked your name on the top. And then they were put away and left on the plane for when we came back to do the real thing. And the...
What do you mean by fitted the chute?
Oh, well, it's like the harness. I mean, it's a sort of an elaboration of the sort of seatbelt idea. It's got all got to be adjusted. A parachute harness is...
You mean adjusted for your size?
Yes, that's right, because of the standard size. And some people couldn't put them on properly because we got so much kit. They didn't put them on correctly, although good, well enough. But the idea of the British chute was that, and the RAF chutes were the same. They had I don't know if you've ever seen them, they have a circular quick release thing here.
On your tummy?
On your chest, about there, yeah. And like you plug in a seatbelt in a car, four straps plugged into the central bit and held it securely. And then when you landed, you twisted it about a quarter of a turn and slapped it, and they all fell out. So it was a quick release idea, but it worked. I mean, I've never seen one fail, you know. You're quite safe with it. And it was, I'm pretty sure that all the RAF chutes were the same pattern, although the Americans weren't. The Americans sort of clipped together, and it took them a long time to get out of their chutes. And the couple of days before D-Day, they were addressed by the General Gale. Later, Sir Richard Gale, who I think he was eventually NATO commander in Europe. He was a brilliant man, a very good fella. He came from Yorkshire too. I think he came from Hull. Not sure. He'd been in World War One, of course, and they all had those senior commanders. Anyway, he told us that what we were going to do. He didn't mention any place names. He said, you're going to attack French coast between two... On each side is a river, and we've got a lot of jobs to do there and hold that, and it's going to be the left flank of the whole Allied beachhead. And then we got, after that, we were given instruction in the transit camp about what we were going to do. Each individual unit, like down to platoons, which are a platoon of about 36 men.
Tony Leake, Reel 2.